This is a CNA podcast.
If there's one sector in Singapore defying economic gravity in a year upended by the pandemic, it's the housing market. In effect, COVID-19 has given no discounted rates for homes here. Record prices have been set in the private residential market, and HDB prices have been rising steadily over the past year. What's behind this incredible resilience of the residential property market? Where Deputy Prime Minister Heng Swee Keat had warned in February that regulators are closely monitoring the situation, what are some indicators that could suggest new cooling measures may be coming our way? And at the heart of it, if prices continue on their uptick, can HDB flats remain affordable for a young married couple looking to buy the new flat? With me to discuss the state of play in the property market is Ismail Ghaffour, CEO of PropNex.
Hi, morning.
And Dr. Lee Naitia, Deputy Director of the Institute of Real Estate and Urban Studies at the NUS.
Hello.
So, gentlemen, my first question is, why is the residential property market still going this strong in a COVID-19 economy?
Singaporeans love to eat food, travel, but they can only eat that much. And now that they can't travel, they have got the bonuses. And one of the other favourite time here is that Singapore has the highest population of home ownership. They take close at heart and always evaluating other opportunities, current low interest rate and many other things do give them that positive sentiment to look at property market.
So you're saying it's an investment class asset that Singaporeans buy into?
Two group of people, because when we even look at it, many of the recent launches, you look at it, the smaller units, the one bedroom and the two bedrooms are snapped up by the first day of the launch in most of the launches. Mm. And that is a clear signal that people don't buy one bedroom to create a family. So an investment angle are huge, especially the very low interest rate environment. People are also so worried that having huge amount of cash within them, today all the rates have come down. So that's one angle. But on the other hand, we are also seeing equally a very strong number of HDB upgraders, and especially with the MOP, minimum occupation period, more numbers are also interested to reorganize the property portfolios.
How do we know that this surge isn't a bubble?
From a theoretical side, when we think about bubble, it's usually when we compare how fast the prices are rising to economic fundamentals, in this case, GDP growth. That is the theoretical model, but in reality, it's actually very hard to prove that there's a bubble. Why is that so? If we look at the current market situation, and Ismail has rightly pointed out, there's a group of upgraders, interest rates are low. So in terms of the economic fundamentals, it's still there. One of the things we see during this COVID pandemic is that most of the people still retain their jobs. Unemployment is usually the thing that we see that, you know, will really break the housing market, because people will be forced to cash out and a lot of downstream issues. But here, the unemployment rate is being kept at a very controlled because of the government subsidies and the government help to help the companies to retain the employment. So that is actually very important here.
But arguably, you know, HDB prices should stabilize overall to reflect the overall aging stock of flats, no? And ultimately, when you look at the flats across Singapore, they're getting older. So why is the price index still going up?
HDB, I look at it from two angles. I know a lot of listeners may not agree with me. I won't say they all will not. There will be two sides of a coin to this for sure. Honestly, if you ask me, when the HDB prices started to move up, I was one very happy person.
Why?
Not because I own multiple HDB properties, because Singaporean can only own one HDB property anyway. It is because a million Singaporean owns HDB and it is one of their biggest assets all their life they worked. And if you look at it, for 6 years continuously, HDB prices have been negative from 2013, 14, 15, 16 up to 19. And that is a very scary thought. Singaporean working and owning a property and paying interest at 2.6% and the HDB prices going on negative, which means come down the years, a lot of people who sell HDBs are going to be negative. And that's not a good thing.
Because not good for retirement adequacy.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about million owners. So after 6 years, when property prices of HDB started to move, I thought this is definitely a welcome news. But it has to be sustainable. The worry thing here is this, the HDB prices have been going up in the fourth quarter, 3.1%, and the first quarter, 3%. If this continue, it is going to be double digit. And that's definitely not healthy in my view. Why again
there's
a strong demand?
There's a certain kind of flat that's selling well and selling at a higher price? Because people have said that newer flats that sell at COV, like the ones that just reached MOP on the market last year, and then when you compare that to older flats, the prices have been flatlining or even coming down. I'm also looking at, for example, Dawson when I say that.
The market has shifted in the last 60 days to 90 days. A lot of data, we are looking at it right now. Today, the demand for HDB has surged. I'll just give you a glimpse. Last year, there were 24,000 transactions, and that was one of the highest numbers in the last 4 or 5 years.
Right.
But the first quarter alone, we are talking about 7,500 HDB houses. And you multiply 7,500 times 4 quarters, it may well hit a 30,000, but I'm not so bullish. So what has happened here is this, the demand for HDB resale flat increased a couple of reasons. Number one, the BTO flats are being delayed in terms of handing over the keys. Some take 4 years, 5 years. Number two, the government in 2019 increased the grant for the first timers up to $160,000. So people are taking advantage of the increased grant amount, and as well as people feel that they can't afford to wait such a long period of time, and that's why people are moving into the HDB properties. 5 years ago and now, even the resale properties, let's say in Choa Chu Kang, would have gone up by more than 50,000.
You talk about the delays to BTO construction, right? And that's reference to the news where 85% of flats face a 6 to 9 months. But arguably, the people who are impacted have already been locked in. They've already bought these BTO flats. Arguably, actually, the effect of that in with curbs on travel from India is that people might be driven to bypass BTO, those who are not locked in, to the resale and private market, no?
Yeah, people who are locked in, they don't have an alternative. They just need to wait out the delay. But those people who now have the opportunity either to go to a BTO or a resale favors a good number to resale, knowing the fact that those people who are locked in are already delayed. What about all those people who are just coming now to go and apply for a BTO and they are looking? So that is a big number of people who are actually moving towards HDB resale properties as well.
When COVID-19 happens, at the very initial stages, of course, there's a lot of concerns. And during the early part, you see that the price are actually softening. But interestingly, after the circuit breaker measures, there seems to be a surge in this HDB demand. And a lot of times we heard the stories are people looking for bigger spaces. They find that the current space are not enough.
Right, upgraders.
I won't say upgraders. They are just very comfortable.
And they've got extra cash lying around?
Yeah, and they realize that, hey, I actually need a bit more space. And so that drives one of the things. Subsequently, the issues of the dormitories on the pandemic spread and impacting the construction sector, that is the second part that leads on to the driving of the HDB resale market. Those that are thinking about getting married, going to buy, they started to look at the resale market because they cannot wait so long. The problem is when they look at the HDB flats, they also have this tendency to also look at the capital returns. So their natural tendency tends to align towards more central, the newer units, because if they get something that is older, they may find that the price points may not be that attractive 5 years later. That's why we see suddenly, you know, the resale market become much more vibrant, much more active. And that also allow a lot of homeowners that reach their MOP to think about their upgrading strategies. So that's why we see how the whole resale market from HDB starts to spill over to the private sector market.
Is there final resolution on whether there are certain kinds of HDB flats that are the recipients of this uptick in interest because of COVID-19? Is it age, location?
The demand is almost nationwide shortage supply. It is more of demand-led than supply crunch. Not many people are selling. But on the other hand, the demand for people, as you said, lateral upgrading from a 4-room to 5-room, from a 3-room to 4-room, that is already creating strong demand, coupled with the newly married couples and some of the first-timers are also looking at HDB. We also have got people from private property downgrading to HDB as well. And these are the people who felt that, okay, at these situations and so on, they want to downsize so that they can cash out as well. So the demand comes from many parts, but targeting at an HDB resale market. And that creates a stronger price uptick.
The question then also is, if COVID is the reason and it's leading to all these reasons why the HDB market is doing so well, what about the private market and in particular the luxury residential market? Why is there still this surge? There was a tenfold volume increase in March, the highest since 2013, despite James Dyson selling his home for $7 million loss. The question also then is this good news that this segment is moderating expectations or bad because it's a sign that the private housing market is doing less well as an investment class? What do you think?
Very interesting. One of the key things when people need to see here is this. When we talk about private market, there is three sectors. Core central region, as very rightfully you have put it, and the rest of the core central region and the outside the central regions. If you look at the demand and supply, as of 1st of April, end of 31st March, the unsold flats in the pipeline have reduced from 2 years ago to 36,000 to 21,000. Therefore, our existing balance stock is so much lower, 21,000. And then you look at 1 year's demand of a private property is about 10,000. Last year was 9,009. The year before was 9,009. So it's about 10,000. But our existing stock that is available is only 21,000. But what is the difference here is this. Out of the 21,000, the core central region seems to have more supply, about 7,000. But the demand of the core central region last year was only 1,000 over was sold. 10-year average is only 2,000. Therefore, the supply of the core central region is at least 3 over years supply, while the mass market demand per year last year was about 4,000 plus, but the supply is only 7,000. Therefore, outlying areas, the current supply can only last less than 1.5 years.
So you're saying that actually the price is not the issue here. It's about the fact that it's a confluence and a coincidence of factors, scarcity on the one hand, but in the core central area, it's abundance of supply that's driving the volume.
Yes. And particularly when we look at new launches, there's no basis to say from month on month or quarter to quarter, because sometimes it all depends on a developer launching a new product. And then we know some of the good product, Midtown Modern was launched in the month of March, and there was a strong take-up rates, 300 over units. And that shows as if there's a strong demand. But that is not the only part that we will have to see. But overall, the real estate market, particularly the new launches, are doing well. And some of the developments that are sensitively priced have got a strong demand for these properties.
So, Naitiar, we know that super rich buyers are snapping up trophy homes all around the world. And some of the most expensive condos downtown, the demand has gone up and competition for such homes are intensifying. There's some level of FOMO to some extent. What gives you confidence, though, that this isn't crowding out Singapore buyers from the city centre who now have to settle for a less expensive apartment somewhere else?
The idea of the homes in the central region, especially like the prime districts, they are usually targeted at the top 1% of the population. The thing is, such supply of homes are extremely limited. If we are talking about the number of penthouses, large units in the core central region, they are very, very rare. For a lot of the foreign buyers or even the high net worth individuals, when they are looking at properties, the first thing is there must be certain kind of familiarity. So you see that they always go for cities that they know very well, London, the gateway cities. In this case, Singapore is one of those that have a very good reputation, be it for business or other reasons. They are attracted to Singapore as a result. So we see that, you know, the demand is there. At this point in time, because of the border restrictions, most of the foreign buyers haven't really come in yet. So to add to the point, that's why we see that, you know, the demand for core central region may not be seen as strong as before, because the foreign buyers are still waiting on the sidelines, waiting to come into Singapore to view. But that does not stop them from stepping up whatever that is in the market, because there's simply not enough. And there's also this concern of wealth preservation. What kind of assets should they invest in? As they look at the stocks, bonds, they are pretty volatile at this point in time. So there's this kind of flight towards what they've deemed as safer assets like gold and all those things. And that's why I think we see them snapping up all these luxury apartments and all those things.
Do you see this demand for downtown homes boosted by this global tech boom. I ask also because there are a few big tech companies who have settled in Singapore over the past couple of years. Mm. And we also know that Chinese big tech Tencent, Alibaba and ByteDance have plans to expand here. Yeah. What's your sense on the impact on the housing market?
I agree to all the things that has been highlighted. But one thing here is actually the COVID have positioned Singapore, the luxury segments, as a standout. Just simply put, a couple of days ago, we know Singapore outplaced New Zealand as the number one country as far as the way COVID is managed in terms of safety, a livable place. And then New Zealand was ahead of us for a couple of quarters. You see, in the eyes of people, you can be a billionaire, but if your country is not in order of your own health and safety, you look at cities that can provide that.
Right, that's a Bloomberg study, right? With ranking the countries in terms of where it's safer based on the vaccinations.
Exactly, So that being the case, what we are seeing here is, put it this way, when foreigners, especially from mainland China, and not only this particular country, we had Taiwanese who bought, and for that matter, Hong Kongers from India, and as well as some of the other Indonesian, some other ASEAN countries, and they are looking at the trophy items of penthouses are the bigger units of 8 million, 10 million and above. But one of the key things here is they are not really crowding at the expense of Singaporeans.
Right.
One of the key things
here
is because the bigger units are hugely available for a Singaporean, he always feels if he wants to pay 15 million and 20 million for a 99-year leasehold penthouse, he has a birthright to buy a landed property which foreigners cannot come and compete. And he can buy a GCB, he can buy a bungalow, and he have got a lot more width in terms of his investment. Singaporeans, they preserve where the future legacy and the capital gain on the freehold property and the landed properties. That's why the GCB market is also doing exceptionally well. While on the other hand, there are the wealthy rich. That's why you will never see a Singaporean trying to pay 57 million for a 99-year-old thing, but I think he will buy a landed property. It's in a good market where I think it's good that some of those high net worth from overseas want to pick up some of these units.
Just to chime in on the part about the crowding out, the main concern here is not so much of crowding out in the prime districts because they are always targeted at the high net worths. Most of the Singaporean high net worths already have something there. Singaporeans, like people who work from the bottom up, where they have a possibility to actually have a share of that pie. Within the CBD or within the, of course, the core central region, there are also smaller units that are available. There are older units available. But in terms of affordability, may not be there. That's why we see Minister Lee talking about having HDB flats in the greater southern areas to create a bit more of the vibrancy and the diversity. So it's not so straightforward because in a city, you cannot just cater to the mass market. You have to cater to a variety of people. And also you need to attract the high net worth individuals to come to Singapore. So they will invest in companies, invest in the economic activities. It's a pretty difficult balance to manage, if I would say.
Both saying that market forces eventually will drive homes in the core central area to be high, and that's a reality that we cannot run away from. But then at the heart of it, the impact, in your view, the average young Singaporean homeowner, do they just then have to settle for HDB in the heartlands and not somewhere central or even in a mature estate where parents live when they first start out as a married couple?
Not really. The statistics have proven. In fact, if you look at the last 5 years, last year, 2020, was the highest percentage of Singaporean buying private properties, 81%, crossed the 80% mark. And we are talking about just 5-6 years ago, it was about 73%. Foreigners used to be about 6-7%. Last year was a drop to half of it, about 3%. Therefore, with all the healthy numbers being recorded last year, what happened? Developers actually price a little bit more lower sensitively, and that's where we saw many of the launches in the core central regions. Either is it the M, the Copper, or even the Mid Midtown Modern. And these are things that in the past, Singaporeans dare not go in because they think these are core areas and I can't afford. And usually in a good market, these developers price such properties close to $3,000 per square foot. But most of these developments went at 2003, 2002, 2004. That means allowing Singaporeans to go in at a lowest price and a lower quantum, because I must also say developers are building smaller units now. So it's a trade-off. If any Singaporeans desire to own in a very good location, they can afford, but they have to trade space.
For Singaporeans, for a young couple, right? In the past, there is this progression. I buy a HDB flat and then I upgrade to a private and then I move up the housing ladder. But now, what we are seeing is a bit different. There are some that are more privileged. Their parents have accumulated wealth over the years. And what we tend to think about is, because we look at the kind of people that are buying in the private market, some of them doesn't seem like they are earning that much to accumulate that kind of savings to able to fork out the down payment. So there must be certain form of intergenerational kind of transfer. And most of them, because their parents have lived through a few cycles, and some of them bought at a very low cycle, so they may actually have accumulated a lot of capital that allow their children to buy. That is probably one of the reasons why we see it. So when we think about the affordability, it becomes a very multifaceted question. It is actually now more related to where you are starting off.
Right, wealth rather than income.
Right.
So then the question is, do you worry about inequality in housing? Because on the one hand, there's the positive story of rising affluence and Singaporeans whose parents have managed to pass on what they've earned to their children, and they are now able to join the ranks of high net worth individuals and buy a nice place downtown. But then on the other hand also, while more are moving towards private, the thing is also there are Singaporeans then who start off and do not have that wealth.
One of the good things about our government, not that I'm pro or not pro or whatever it is there are schemes available, because in any particular country, if you say, we can't all of us stay in the core central region, it's not possible. But the thing here is this, we know the government will be time and again tested come election. Are the people happy with the current state of affairs? Though I don't go into the borders of politics, but what am I trying to say here is this. The government's conviction here is this, every Singaporean should have an affordable home at entry level. And that's why we look at it from a HDB grant perspective, it has increased from 30,000 to 50,000 to 80,000 to 120. As of 2019, it's up to $160,000 of taxpayers' monies are given to the lower tier of income Singaporeans to own a HDB property. Then the second thing here is this, are we all just happy with being just HDB? And that's why we have the other class, which is known as executive condominium. And again, it has been debated in parliament. Why must taxpayers subsidize the Singaporeans who desire to have a swimming pool by providing an executive condominium? But this again has been said, it is the aspiration of Singaporeans that we have to fulfill. Every year, we are talking about 2,000 executive condominium. What Singaporeans need here is this, I have an option, but I may not choose to upgrade. But the minute there's no EC, then they feel that they don't have an option. So I think there are few schemes that are available out in the market.
Of course, the government have the HDB schemes, etc. And there are certain schemes. But when we think about the amount of money that one starts off and then how it rolls up, be it they invest in capital markets, be it they invest in residential markets, is going to be very different. For one person who has maybe $4 million available to do whatever he wants, be it buying a house, starting up, compared to the other, who's probably have the same intellectual, but just don't have that amount of cash. So that is a kind of a gap that we may see widening, and of course, maybe of concern. The question is, how much are we going to subsidize for this gap to narrow it? I don't really have an answer for it.
I think none of us have.
Yeah.
But I guess the question then is, just switching gears a bit, do you worry about the affordability of homes for newly married couples? Because just last year, the median monthly household income declined for the first time in 10 years. And yet that stands in stark contrast to rising prices, not just in the private residential market, but also HDB, which saw a 5% rise.
The main problem here sometimes it's actually a mismatch of expectations more than affordability. And the way people read affordability is just a statistic. And depending on what are the parameters you put in, Singapore housing can be very affordable or can be very unaffordable, depending on what type of housing, what type of expectations they put in. And a lot of times we realize that a lot of people find that housing is unaffordable because of the kind of constraints they put themselves in. I want it to be in District 9, 10, 11, freehold, 3-bedroom. And then they realize the prices are off range. And then they say, well, it's unaffordable. Even when they are looking at the resale market, they must look at certain areas. And sometimes it's due to because they wanted to stay near their parents who are in the mature estate. Those flats usually command a premium.
Right, don't build sandcastles on the air then.
Correct.
But all said, I think it's fair. The authorities and government will keep a very keen eye on the runaway prices. I, for one, don't support a double-digit growth in an annually for be it HDB or private. No doubt I say the HDB market has been the doldrums for 6 years and finally we see some form of a sunlight, and that's for the benefit of the million existing owners. Exactly as you said, from a young couple who's going to start a home, is it affordable? No doubt the grant has been there, but the grant can only help that much because if there is any element of cash above the value being demanded because of in a very buoyant market, a young couple still can't afford to purchase a unit. So this is important to monitor the market, and if there is any other, not necessarily a cooling measures, some kind of a restriction right. need to be brought into play.
Well, right. let's get into that then. Cooling measures, right? Talk about the likelihood of that, given that we've seen strong volume, high prices, limited government land sales, and there's also talk of an en bloc revival.
Yep. To start with en bloc, I don't think there's a fever. The only fever we are experiencing is COVID once in a while. There are a lot of people who are hopeful of a revival, especially those of them who have missed the boat the last time. Today, developers are very much more careful. They're very measured. Because from before the cooling measures were introduced, now developers are subject to an additional 5%. And they have to factor that as well. And also the looming cooling measures. Yeah, if a developer go and en bloc and pay a price and cooling measures announced the next month, so he's going to have a double barrel whammy.
Right, he's
going
to have a lot of buffer then.
Yeah, so that's why. People are really very careful as far as the en bloc prices are concerned. But on the other hand, what is more important here is this. Is a cooling measure necessary? Yes. And what should be the triggering point? To me, the answer should be when the property market is not sustainable in its price growth, cooling measures have to step in.
But what does that mean? Because we've heard so many times bandied around the idea that if prices outpace economic fundamentals, is it really just the price index versus GDP growth? What's your take, Naitya?
That is usually one of the common indicators when we look at the price growth and the economic GDP growth and whether they kind of aligned. The only problem is that when it comes to housing, at least for the last 5 to 10 years, it becomes more of like an alternative asset. People has looked at the home purchase, they have looked at it more like an investment asset at the same time. And that complicates matters. If you are buying for home occupancy, I think the market should be fine. Then what is going to happen when we think about these cooling measures? Cooling measures by itself, it tends to always add a certain form of cost to some groups of people. And in most cases, the buyers. And they try to restrict people from maybe buying too many properties, overstretching themselves.
The past cooling measures have already addressed that, the ABSD.
Correct. And then the question is, if we introduce something more, then it may have an unintended contractionary effect on the economy, which is actually recovering slowly. It's kind of in a very difficult position. How do we do a cooling measure to cool down the market, but at a very targeted approach? And then we look at the HDB market, it's even trickier because if we do any cooling measures, it's going to impact not on the buyers, but it's going to also impact on the sellers. And the sellers will see their asset value drop. And of course, that will be very unpopular political situation.
So I hear you say that the cooling measures will not be costless to the government and the economy as a whole when the industry and construction remains fragile and the economy has really just gotten started with this recovery. Right. But then can you explain what this balancing act that regulators are trying to pull off involves?
They're trying to pull off a few things. First, they want to make sure that when everyone purchased their property, they understand the kind of risks involved, the kind of financial prudence that they need to take care of, whether they can afford the future increase in interest rates. If you look at the kind of warnings that have been announced or being talked about, it's usually talking about whether you can afford in the future when interest rates are increasing. So the idea is the people may be able to afford private housing, HDB or new sales, but they may not be able to weather the storm when interest rates go up or when there's certain black swan event happening again. That is where the government is coming. The people have to take a more realistic view of their finances and their own growth in terms of wage and everything.
Just second last question, Ismail. Is there a sweet spot for the residential property market growth where it's growing at a healthy rate, owners are happy, but it's not unaffordable for buyers, and there's no fear of a bubble? I mean, how is this then related to the rate of the growth of the economy? Is there a magic figure that they have in mind?
It's my opinion, because obviously isn't anywhere to in a textbook, it's in a guideline in terms of cooling measures and so on. But just to touch on a little bit more on the cooling measures, the government or whoever the authorities have to be also be quite clear in their implementation or calibrating existing cooling measures. Whatever it is, it should not penalize first-time homeowners. That's not been fair, because they are trying to start a home or they have an aspiration and desires, and if anything curtail their desires, and then you're making it unfair disadvantage to them in order to start off. That's the first point. The second point here is increasing any further ABSD or loan to value will have little impact, as you said, those rich who have got the wealth and the parents give it the money, the parents have to just give a bit more. So it is not going to make a huge of a difference. The point of right now, based on financial prudence, it is likely calibration of the TDSR, total debt servicing ratio, is currently at 60%. And I think of all likelihood, the next round, it is going to be this area. It could be reduced to 50% or 45%. So the government is giving a very clear signal. If they go into this direction, I want all of you to exercise more prudence in the way you leverage. Even in the case of an increase of an interest or you lose your job, you are not overly exposed. And that will have trickling effect on people being able to buy, how much they can buy and how many they can buy. So these are some of the areas all definitely are likely to happen. Then the question that you ask, what is that magical percentage? To me, we cannot just be following the GDP. GDP has got many other things to take into consideration. As far as, in my view, private property or even HDB market going in the range of anything between 4 to 6. Sweet spot, 5%. If it goes in a year, it's perfectly okay. Your interests are 2 to 3%. It goes slightly ahead of your interest, and therefore, that's where the capital appreciation takes place. 5 to 6%, it will take a good 15 years before a property price even double. That's even seems, based on inflation creeping up, reasonable. That's why I don't think a double-digit growth in a singular year, and if it continues for 5 years, property prices are going to be 50%. Our salary, our income cannot keep pace. And every 5 years, not forgetting, we have a Czech election as well.
Just last question then, Aijia, to you. I think Ismail has brought up a whole range of indicators that people should be looking for, even though it's very complex and there's no direct relation. There's the GDP growth number, interest rates, the price increase for private property, and also wage growth. Are there any indicators that buyers and sellers should be looking out for if they're trying to anticipate when there might be a cooling measure slapped on?
In the past, one of the key indicators that we used is actually the number of times the ministers come out to talk about it. It's pretty accurate. But I think besides that, all this economic kind of considerations, the other one that probably may spark or trigger off is actually the kind of responses they got from their social media, from their different channels. And I think that is something that is also ongoing, that they are receiving feedback, whether to implement or not. When anything that they implement, it will have severe impacts on all the different sectors, including the financial sector, which is one of our core sectors in Singapore. So they have to consider all the different issues.
Right. So it sounds like a lot of qualitative, quantitative, and it might not be directly rational, but it is a whole suite of measures.
Right.
Okay, I see that. Thank you very much, Ismail and Naita, for coming on our show. Well, there you have it. It doesn't look like the fires or that love affair investors have with the Singapore property market will be doused anytime soon, even with a raging COVID pandemic. This has been Heart of the Matter, brought to you by Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. And I'm Lin Tzu Ling, signing off until next week.